This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Globally, more than 665,000 people have died from COVID-19. It's more than 150,000 deaths in the United States and also more than 90,000 in Brazil. And the worldwide number of infections hits a milestone of 17 million, while the number of U.S. infections exceeds 4.4 million. It is 2.5 million in Brazil. As the world races to find a vaccine and a treatment for COVID-19, there is seemingly no antidote in sight for the burgeoning outbreak of coronavirus conspiracy theories, hoaxes, anti-mask myths, and sham cures. The phenomenon, unfolding largely on social media, escalated this week when U.S. President Donald Trump retweeted a false video about an anti-malarial drug being a cure for the virus, and it was revealed that Russian intelligence is spreading disinformation about the crisis through English language websites. Experts are worrying that the torrent of bad information is dangerously undermining efforts to slow the virus, whose death toll in the U.S. continues to rise. Brazil reopened Wednesday to foreign visitors arriving by plane, hoping to revive its lockdown-devastated tourism industry. This is despite the spread of the new coronavirus in the country. In a decree published in the Government Gazette, Brazil extended coronavirus-related bans on foreign travelers arriving by land or sea for another 30 days, but said the four-month-old restrictions will no longer bar the entry of foreigners arriving by air. Brazil ranks third globally in COVID-19-related deaths and infections. This is VOA News. Chinese drug maker Sinopharm and Piranha State have agreed to launch the fourth major COVID-19 vaccine trial in Brazil and will seek regulatory approval on the next 2 weeks. Trial by Sinopharm would join phase three trials already announced in Brazil by AstraZeneca, Sinovac Biotech, and Pfizer partnership with BioNTech. The head of the Piranha Technology Institute said that they would soon finalize their proposal and submit it for approval with the federal health regulator. Brazil's COVID-19 outbreak is the world's worst outside the United States. Britain said Wednesday it has signed a deal for up to 60 million doses of a potential coronavirus vaccine being developed by Sanofi and GlaxoSmithKline. With four deals so far, Britain has struck more coronavirus vaccine supply agreements than any other country. The UK has secured 250 million doses for a population of 66 million. Having endured what was surely a record-shattering slump last quarter, the U.S. economy faces a dim outlook as a resurging coronavirus intensifies doubts about any sustained recovery the rest of the year. A huge plunge in consumer spending as people stayed home and avoided shopping, traveling, or gathering in crowds as the virus raged is estimated to have sent the economy sinking at a roughly 32% annual rate in the April-June quarter. That would be more than triple the previous worst quarterly economic fall set up in 1958. Iran's paramilitary Revolutionary Guard has launched underground ballistic missiles. The launch is part of an exercise involving a fake aircraft carrier in the Strait of Hormuz. This is according to a state television report Wednesday, and it represents the latest barrage in a drill that saw two American bases temporarily go on alert over the launches Tuesday. State TV says drones separately targeted the bridge of the fake aircraft carrier. State TV did not immediately air footage of the launches, nor did it identify the missiles used in the drill. NASA is set to launch an ambitious mission to Mars Thursday with the liftoff of its next-generation Perseverance rover, a six-wheeled robot tasked with deploying a mini-helicopter, testing out equipment for future human missions, and searching for traces of past Martian life. The $2.4 billion mission slated for liftoff at 7:50 Eastern Standard Time from Florida's Cape Canaveral is planned as the U.S. Space Agency's ninth trek to the Martian surface. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. Today is Thursday, July 30th. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington this week, and next I'm filling in for James Butte. We have a great show for you lined up, so do not reduce the volume. Here are the stories we are covering. Troops have deployed in Sudan's Darfur region to quell unrest.
These crimes are an extension of the crimes of Omar al-Bashir regime, displacing the indigenous people and dominating their lands. The Khartoum government is unable to provide security in Darfur.
That was Mohamed Abdurrahman Al-Nair of the Sudan Liberation Movement Abdul Wahid Faction Rebel Group. Also ahead, the opposing sides in Mali's political crisis appear to be hardening their positions. Somalia's livestock industry struggles amid COVID-19. The pandemic has hit Botswana's truck drivers. African migrants face abuse on the journey to Europe through the Sahara Desert. And an activist speaks out against the jailing of Egyptian women over their social media posts.
The women didn't commit any crime. They were just expressing themselves online, dancing and singing. Men do the same, yet we don't hear of any men going to jail for dancing and singing on social media.
That was Salma El Hosseini, an Egyptian activist. All those stories are next on Daybreak Africa. The first of thousands of troops meant to quell a string of deadly attacks in Sudan's Darfur area have arrived in the war-torn region, the country's government and a civilian witness said Wednesday. Dozens of people have been killed in militia raids across Darfur in recent weeks, prompting Sudan's transitional government to announce on Sunday that it would send a joint protection force to the region. Journalist Michael Atit has the story from Khartoum.
Speaking to the press in Khartoum Wednesday, Sudan's Information Minister Faisal Mohamed Saleh confirms that some troops are on the ground in parts of Darfur. Sudan's Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok ordered the deployment on Sunday after an attack left 60 dead, including children, and dozens wounded in Misteri village in West Darfur. Saleh says a total of 24,000 troops will be deployed in the coming days to provide protection to civilians and allow them to carry out their agricultural activities.
We are planning to have 6,000 from police, 6,000 from the army, 6,000 from the rapid support forces, and 6,000 from other security agencies. And some of them have already arrived in some parts of Darfur and are expected to provide security and protect civilians. This is a rainy season, and most people from the affected areas have reported that civilians are unable to go to their farms.
Thousands of displaced people have fled to West Darfur state capital, Al Janina, to escape the killings in Misteri village. A local resident of Al Janina confirms that members of the joint force arrived in the area Wednesday. He said they arrived in pickup trucks and gathered around the town's military barracks. The local resident, Abdurrahim Abdullah, says they don't know when the troops will be deployed to surrounding villages, including Misteri, some 40 kilometers south of Al Janina.
We don't have details of when they will be deployed, but the situation might not change much. Our people are still displaced after the massacre.
Darfuri rebel leader Mohamed Abdurrahman Al-Nair of the Sudan Liberation Movement, Abdul Wahid Rebel Group, condemned the attacks on civilians in Darfur. Al-Nair blames whom he calls elements of the Bashir's regime in the Sudanese transitional government for the violence. Omar al-Bashir was overthrown last year and is currently in prison after being convicted of corruption. The rebel leader Al-Nair accused government figures linked to Bashir of supporting the armed militia known as Janjaweed to destabilize Darfur.
These crimes are an extension of the crimes of Omar al-Bashir regime, displacing the indigenous people and dominating their lands. The Khartoum government is unable to provide security in Darfur, therefore requires the intervention of the international community to protect civilians.
Since 2007, a joint UN and African Union peacekeeping mission has deployed in Darfur. However, the mission has come under criticism in the past for not doing enough to protect civilians. In recent years, the UN Security Council voted to withdraw some UNAMID troops. The mission is expected to close entirely in December this year. UNAMITI spokesperson Ashraf Issa said he believes the timing of the latest attacks is unfortunate when peacekeepers have left most areas in the region. He said UNAMITI welcomed the announcement by Prime Minister Hamdok on the deployment of Joint Protection Force to protect civilians in Darfur. The UNAMID official said he hopes the force will be fully deployed as soon as possible and will be adequately equipped and trained to protect all residents of Darfur without exception.
The primary responsibility of protecting civilians lies with the sovereign state, the government of Sudan. UNAMID, wherever it is still operates, also conducts physical protection of civilians, as we responded to the incidents in Kutum and Fatabarno, where we have troops.
Darfur has been engulfed in war since 2003. The UN estimated that between 300 to 400,000 people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced. For VOA News, I am Michael Atid in Khartoum.
The opposing sides in Mali's political crisis appear to be hardening their positions just days after West African leaders tried to break the impasse. For months, opposition groups calling themselves the M5 RFP have staged mass protests against the government of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. The protesters accuse Keita's government of corruption and nepotism and of failing to tackle widespread insecurity. West African leaders of the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, have tried to end the crisis. They urged the formation of a unity government, the resignation of 31 lawmakers whose elections are disputed, and the dissolution of the country's constitutional court. They also called for an inquiry into deaths and property destruction during the protests. But now it appears that neither side has accepted the resolutions from ECOWAS. For more, I spoke to VOA's Madibo Dembele in Bamako, Mali.
Today, the M5 RFP did a press conference, and in that press conference, the charismatic Imam Mahmoud Diko showed up. They rejected in bloc all the resolution made by the ECOWAS leader, and they are planning to resume with the civil disobedience just 48 hours after the Muslim holiday celebration, which is on July 31st in Mali. And at the same time also, they renew the request that Ibrahim Boubacar Keita should step down.
You mentioned Mahmoud Diko. He is this charismatic imam who is a leading figure of the M5 opposition. Now, in the past, he hasn't always called directly for President Keita to step down, but now it looks like he's fully on board with the rest of the opposition. Is that correct?
Let's remember that the M5 has three main components. We have the EMK, which is like Hope for Mali, Digo organization, and politician organization, which is called FSD. So today, they speak as a bloc. Digo show up during that meeting to just clearly show that he's standing behind the decision of the M5, which is the resignation of the president of Mali.
Now, what about the government side? For instance, these 31 lawmakers whose elections were disputed, have they accepted the ECOWAS demand to resign?
Today, again, another press conference was taking place at the same time that the M5 was doing its own press conference. The current president of the National Assembly, Musa Tembine, who is also part of the 31 lawmakers, they did a press conference where they are refusing to step down because they think the ECOWAS is not allowed to tell them to resign. Because to them, that's also a violation of Mali constitution. So, which means the conflict is really getting complicated.
Now, last of all, President Keita already dissolved the constitutional court. That appears to be the only demand by ECOWAS that's actually been carried out. Has this succeeded in any way?
The president of the constitutional court is appealing the decision made by the president. So she sent an appeal. I think the president has 4 months to respond. And she's even claiming that the president should or could be prosecuted for high treason. So let's wait and see.
That was VOA's Madibo Dembele in Bamako, Mali. Daybreak Africa will continue to update you with the latest on Mali's political crisis. The U.S. military announced it conducted an airstrike against the Al-Shabaab rebel group Wednesday in Somalia. The U.S. military's Africa Command, called AFRICOM, said the strike hit around the town of Jilib in southern Somalia. AFRICOM claims it killed one, quote, terrorist, end quote, and wounded another. However, social media users circulated images claiming to show civilians hit by the strike. AFRICOM said it was aware of allegations of civilian casualties, but said it assessed no civilians were hurt. AFRICOM's announcement of the new airstrike comes one day after the U.S. admitted that a previous airstrike in the same town of Jilib in February had killed one civilian and wounded three others. AFRICOM had originally claimed that airstrike killed a, quote, terrorist, end quote, but changed its assessment after reviewing new evidence. Staying in Somalia, the Horn of Africa nation's livestock industry is reeling after Saudi Arabia canceled the Hajj Muslim pilgrimage for foreigners due to COVID-19. Somalia earns the majority of its export earnings from livestock, and it normally sells millions of cattle and goats to Saudi Arabia to feed pilgrims at the Hajj. Mohammed Yusuf reports.
42-year-old Hassan Farah is a livestock trader in southern Somalia. He typically will be a busy man at this time of year, loading ships with livestock to Gulf countries, but not this year. He says the coronavirus has destroyed his business. He says before the virus, we used to export livestock. We used to get our livelihood. Then the virus came and everything we are doing came to a stop. He says here in Lower Juba, we would export livestock 2-3 times a month, but now we export once every 3 months. According to a 2019 Veterinary Medicine and Science report, Saudi Arabia imports upward of 3 million heads of goats, sheep, cattle and camels during the Hajj season. Somali traders supply a large number of the animals. Khalid Said is a livestock coordinator for the UN Food and Agriculture Organization in Somalia. He says, despite the virus and restrictions, Somali traders were able to export at least 1.3 million animals in 4 months this year after Saudi Arabia lifted the ban on Somali livestock.
The ban was lifted from Somali livestock early this year. And since then, immediately the exportation started to the Middle East. So I can say from April to end of July, the value of the animals exported to the Middle East, it is around 90 to 95 million USD dollars.
However, Abdiaziz Bashir Aden, Kismayo Livestock Director, says that's a low number compared to previous years. He says livestock traders target a time like this during the Hajj period. The cancellation of the pilgrimage has made the situation even worse, he says. The prices have gone down. For example, he says a goat that was going for $70-$80 now is being sold at $50, and the cancellation of the pilgrimage is to blame for the lower price. According to the World Bank, Somalia has an estimated 53 million heads of livestock, which account for about 75% of Somalia's exports. The pandemic has left tens of thousands of families without an income and little hope of making a living unless COVID-19 is brought under control. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Botswana's truck drivers, who deliver the majority of the landlocked country's goods from coronavirus-hit South Africa, are also responsible for 80% of the country's reported COVID-19 cases. Health authorities started testing all truckers for the virus in May, delaying them at the border for days at a time. Mkondise Dube reports on their plight from Gaborone.
Trucker Wisiso Balati used to look forward to his daily drive from his home country, Botswana, to pick up goods in neighboring South Africa. But since the COVID-19 pandemic, border trips for truckers like him have become a nightmare of being tested and forced to wait up to 5 days for results. Balati says the conditions at the border check are awful, with no food vendors or proper toilets. At times, he thinks of quitting his job. However, officials in Botswana say with nearly 500,000 cases of the fast-spreading virus in South Africa, testing people who cross the border is vital. After Botswana recorded a new daily record of confirmed cases, truckers are being watched carefully.
These are largely border cases. and 80% of these 50 cases were non-citizen. It also tells a story where the threat level or the pressure of risk is based. It is at the border.
Analyst Lawrence Okeditse says the pandemic should be a wake-up call for Botswana's reliance on South African goods.
This COVID thing has proven that the country is in a precarious position, particularly when you look into its dependence on South Africa. The country needs to be at a point where it now can depend on itself for, you know, a good number of vital supplies. You know, we import literally everything.
Botswana's government figures show South Africa accounted for nearly three quarters of the country's imports as of April this year. For the moment, nothing has changed and the truckers remain vulnerable to the virus. Of Botswana's 739 COVID-19 cases, 620 have been truck drivers testing positive at the country's entry points. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
A new report says thousands of African refugees and migrants die and suffer horrific abuse while traveling across the Sahara Desert towards Libya and the gateway to Europe. The report by the UN Refugee Agency and the Mixed Migration Center at the Danish Refugee Council describes the harrowing journeys taken by East and West African migrants. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Around 16,000 refugees and migrants surveyed over the last 2 years have described the brutality and inhumanity suffered at the hands of smugglers, traffickers, militias, and even government officials. The UN Refugee Agency Special Envoy for the Central Mediterranean, Vincent Costel, says 47% of the victims have reported the perpetrators of violence were law enforcement authorities.
Whereas in the past, we believed that it was mainly smugglers and traffickers. Yes, they are key perpetrators of violence, but the primary perpetrators of violence are people who are supposed to protect.
The report documents at least 72 deaths a month for a total of 1,750 fatalities in 2018 and 2019, making the desert route one of the deadliest in the world. Authors of the report suggest the number is greatly underestimated. Ayala Erin Bonfilio is regional coordinator for the Mixed Migration Center North Africa. She says 43% of refugees and migrants surveyed in Libya cited it as the most dangerous country on the migratory route, followed by Niger, Algeria, and Mali.
The main threats in Libya include physical violence, followed by detention, death, robbery, and sexual violence. Men are more vulnerable compared to women. However, women were considerably more likely to experience or witness sexual abuse. And the reason for men being more vulnerable on the whole could, for instance, in the case of detention, be related to the fact that detention was linked to forced labor, and so they were commodified.
The report says the men, women, and children who survive the horrific ordeals they have suffered often are left with lasting and severe mental health issues due to trauma. Thousands of refugees and migrants who arrive in Libya and make the sea crossing to Europe are intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard and returned to Libya. Many are held in official government detention centers where they reportedly face abuse. Many others, the report says, end up in unofficial centers or warehouses controlled by smugglers and traffickers who physically abuse them to extract payments for their release. The refugee and migration agencies say these vulnerable people should under no circumstances be returned to Libya, as it is not a safe place. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Earlier this week, an Egyptian court sentenced five young women to 2 years in prison for posting dance videos on the social media app TikTok. The court claims the videos were, quote, indecent, end quote. Critics of the controversial court decision describe it as a further crackdown on self-expression in Egypt's conservative society. The women were also fined 300,000 Egyptian pounds, which is nearly $19,000 each, for, quote, violating the values and principles of the Egyptian family, end quote, including promoting immorality and human trafficking. The prosecution statement named just two of the defendants, 20-year-old student Hanin Hossam and 22-year-old Mawada El Adam, and said the three others helped run their social media accounts. Both women recently vaulted to TikTok fame, amassing millions of followers for their video snippets set to catchy Egyptian club pop tracks. In their respective 15-second clips, the women wearing makeup pose in cars, dance in kitchens, and joke in skits, familiar and seemingly tame content for the platform. But their social media stardom became their undoing in Egypt, where citizens can land in prison for vague crimes such as, quote, misusing social media, disseminating fake news, or inciting debauchery and immorality, end quote. For more, journalist Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo spoke to Geneva-based Egyptian activist Salma El-Hosseini. El-Hosseini told him that she was shocked by the verdicts.
I'm really shocked and outraged at the sentencing of the women. The women didn't commit any crime. They were just expressing themselves online, dancing and singing. Men do the same, yet we don't hear of any men going to jail for dancing and singing on social media. It just shows what I already knew growing up. Is basically what is allowed for men and boys is not allowed for women and girls.
El-Hosseini rejected the charges against the women of promoting immorality and human trafficking.
So first, let me ask, what defines morality? This depends on which Egyptian you ask. In some families, female genital mutilation is moral. And what about marital rape, for example? That's not criminalized in Egyptian law, but it's immoral for me. So first, it's a vague term that is impossible to define, and what can be considered moral for some is actually prohibited by international human rights law. And then for human trafficking, I don't see how social media influencers can be accused of that. Companies pay influencers to promote their products all the time. So if the state has a problem with social media influencers making a living online, maybe they should tax them, but not accuse them of human trafficking.
This isn't the first time women on social media have been jailed in Egypt. Cairo's Misdemeanors Economic Court last month jailed celebrity Egyptian belly dancer Sama El-Masri for 3 years for inciting debauchery and immorality as part of a crackdown on social media. A court released her on bail in June, but she was rearrested after the prosecution found new evidence. The activist El-Hosseini said this is part of a wider pattern.
State violence against women in Egypt is not new. It's a systematic issue. The state acts like the patriarch, controlling women and girls' bodies. So this is just a continuation of state policy. What's new here is that there are social media influencers who are men, and they are competing with these women. And these men are inciting hatred against women and violence and urging people to report these women to the police. They called it the cleaning campaign, for example. So the state, instead of stopping this hate speech and protecting women from cyberbullying, which these men are doing, the state decides in the end to go after women because essentially it thinks women's bodies need to be controlled.
She called on Egypt's government to release the women.
It's a signal from the state to women that this is not allowed, that you cannot do this on social media, you cannot express yourself, and you can definitely not have influence because that's not your place. And that's very dangerous and not, definitely not acceptable in 21st century.
A lawyer for one of the women has said they would appeal the verdict. That's it for this Thursday, July 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of managing editor James Butte, producer Nicole Beckford, and the rest of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.